listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television by the Free Speech Television Network on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide. Greetings, and it's Friday, so of course it's time for our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, the guy I think of as America's senator, although the people of Vermont are very, very pleased that he represents them. Bernie, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. The planet is on fire, and the Republicans are insisting that the president not be able to pay the bills that they ran up with their craziness over the last few years. What's going on in D.C.? It seems like it's insane.
What's going on right now is that our Republican friends have decided that for the first time in the history of the United States of America, our country, the largest and wealthiest country in the world, will not pay its bills. And that is the position of a number of
Republicans. And obviously, if you go that direction and you don't pay your bills, you're going to bring forth not only an American financial crisis, but an international financial crisis. Mm-hmm. And that is just, you know, unthinkable. The other thing that's going on, Tom, is that my colleague, Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, has declared that revenue is off the table, that we don't have to talk about revenue anymore because as a result of the fiscal cliff, we raised $620 billion in revenue by asking people making $400,000 a year or more to pay somewhat more in taxes. Meanwhile, and this is the important point that everybody has got to understand, virtually every Republican and some Democrats now want to go forward in terms of deficit reduction by cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and some want to go further and cut nutrition programs, education, environmental programs, and virtually every program that the middle class and working families of this country depend upon. And that is something I will do my best to oppose. One of the mechanisms that they're looking at in order to cut Social Security is a so-called chained CPI, which is a reconfiguration as to how you do cost of living adjustments for seniors. And the argument is that the current system is too generous, which is absolutely untrue in my view. In fact, the current determination for COLAs for seniors is, to my view, underestimates the needs of seniors. But in any case, if they got their way, what we would see is very significant cuts in Social Security, such that if you're 65 today, when you're 75, you'd be receiving about $600 a year less, and by the time you are 85, about $1,000 a year less. Furthermore, there would be cuts for disabled veterans, if you can believe that. In terms of Medicare, there are proposals to raise the eligibility age, to make other types of cuts, Medicaid cuts, etc. The point here that I hope everybody understands is that we can do deficit reduction in a way that is fair. And let me just give you some examples of that. Right now, while my friend Senator McConnell tells you that we don't need more revenue, the truth is we certainly do need more revenue, that today, at 15.7%, revenue as a percentage of gross domestic product is the lowest that it has been in 60 years. So if we look back just into the Clinton era, when this country ran a several hundred billion dollar surplus, revenue as part of GDP was over 20%. Now it is under 16%. Now, how can we raise additional revenue in a way that is fair? Well, for a start, we should understand that in 2011, corporations paid just 12% of their profits in taxes, and that, Tom, is the lowest since 1972.
Wow.
We should understand that at 1.6%, corporate revenue corporate revenue as a percentage of GDP is lower than any other major country in the OECD. And that includes, of course, Europe, Britain, Australia, South Korea, Switzerland, Norway, you name it.
Corporate revenue or corporate tax payments?
Corporate revenue, the amount of revenue that corporations contribute to the federal government as a percentage of GDP.
Revenue, in other words, revenue to pay to the government, which would be corporate income taxes.
Right,
and taxes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, got it.
So it's only 1.6%, which is a lower percentage than any other major country.
Wow.
Point being that when our corporate friends get on television, they say, oh, my goodness, we need tax reform. Corporations are just paying so much. By and large, that is absolutely not true. What you have are nominal rates on the books, which in fact are high. But in terms of what they actually pay compared to other countries, it is not high. Furthermore, you're looking at a situation, hard to believe, that one out of four major profitable corporations is paying nothing in federal income taxes. We're losing about $100 billion every year because corporations and the wealthy are stashing their money in tax shelters in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda and elsewhere. So if you look at what corporations actually pay, if you look at some of the major oil companies, you look at some of the major Wall Street companies, in any given year, you could find a major company like an Exxon Mobil reporting to the Securities Exchange Commission, say in 2009, that not only did they not pay any federal income taxes, they actually received a significant rebate from the IRS. Bottom line here is we have a choice as a nation. And what the choice is do we cut Social Security that has nothing to do with the deficit because it's independently funded by the payroll tax? Do you cut Medicare? Do you cut Medicaid? Do you cut education and nutrition and other programs in the middle of a terrible recession where unemployment is sky high, where seniors are struggling in many cases to keep their heads above water, where kids are graduating from college incredibly deep in debt? Do you cut those programs, or do you say to large corporations, guess what? We have a serious deficit problem. You're going to have to help us not only deal with the deficit, but bring in revenue so that we can create the jobs that our country desperately needs. So that's one area that I think we have to focus a whole lot of attention on. The other area that I've been working on, we just announced yesterday, that we are going to be introducing major legislation dealing with global warming. I hope that our listeners know that all over the world, including the United States, we are seeing significant weather aberrations. Last year was the hottest year on record in the United States. We have seen a situation where last year, the federal government declared 48 states in this nation having emergency situations.
Wow.
Because of extreme weather problems, whether it's fires, floods, or droughts. Right now, you are seeing in the continent of Australia a continent burning up with record-breaking heat levels, where you are seeing drought, and it may well be that Australia is the canary in the coal mine here. But all over this world, we're seeing serious problems. The time is long overdue for the Congress to get its act together dealing with global warming.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. He'll be taking your calls at 866-987-THOM right after this break. So stick around. And also check out Senator Sanders' website. It's at sanders.senate.gov.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Brunch with Bernie, sanders.senate.gov. Check it out. Sign up for his newsletter. It's great. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line taking your calls. And Mary in, is that Bernie, Texas?
It sure is.
Wow. Okay, you're on the air.
Did they name a town after me in Texas then?
Yes, they did. I asked the Chamber of Commerce, and they said yes.
Thank you.
Bertie, I wanted to know, why don't we put a big enough import tax on the companies that took our jobs overseas so to pay them to bring them back here where they make their money?
Well, Mary, thank you very much for that question. And that is an issue that, you know, Tom and I have talked about for many, many years. And it's an issue we'll continue to work on. I don't know how you grow the middle class, how workers earn decent wages, if we continue to see a decline in our manufacturing sector. Over the last 10 years, we have lost some 55,000 factories. Unfettered free trade has cost us millions of decent paying jobs, jobs that used to be the heart and soul of middle class America. And I worry very much that many of the new jobs that are being manufactured, that are being created over the years, are going to be low-wage jobs, not enabling workers to earn the kind of money they need to live a middle-class life. So I am absolutely in agreement. I'm speaking to you as somebody who has never once voted for any of these trade agreements, NAFTA, Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China, Central American Free Trade Agreement. I think essentially what they are about is making it easier for companies to shut down in America, find cheap labor abroad. So your answer about establishing a tariff, bringing back tariffs, and having us with free trade that works for workers and not just large corporations is exactly what we've got to do.
Larry, I'm sorry, I don't see a city or state for you. Where are you calling from?
Mills River, North Carolina.
Oh, okay, great. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Yes, Larry, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders?
Yes.
You know, we keep talking about cutting the budget and where all the money's going to come from and everything, and they want to cut Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security and all that stuff. Why don't they cut the space race down a little bit? How many billions of dollars are they spending in the space race? And how do we don't know that all the rockets that they're sending up is what's causing all the problem with the ozone and atmosphere. You know, I don't think automobiles is causing it.
Well, I half agree with you, Larry, but I half don't agree with you. I think the way to do deficit reduction is certainly not to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other important programs. A whole lot of people in our country are hurting, and I think sometimes Congress forgets that we have elderly people trying to survive on $13,000 a year. You got workers who are making $9 or $10 an hour who are dependent upon Medicaid. You have senior citizens who have very little money, and Medicare is life and death to them. So, you know, I will do everything I can to prevent cuts in those programs. I think that the real way you move toward deficit reduction at a time when our country has gross income and wealth inequality, where the people on top doing phenomenally well while working people are seeing a decline in their standard of living, you've got to ask the wealthy and large corporations, as I mentioned earlier, to stop paying their fair share of taxes. We took a baby step forward on that a couple of weeks ago in terms of fiscal cliff issue, but we've got to do more. And also, I think we could take a hard look at military spending. I don't know about the space program. Space program, I think, is valuable. I think it provides some new technology. I would much prefer to focus on wasteful military spending.
Manuel in Grays Lake, Illinois, listening on WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders and Tom.
Hey, Manuel.
Senator Sanders, I was watching last night when you were on the Ed Schultz show for the segment, and I was very happy that you were talking about the issues of poverty in our country.
Yep.
And what I was wondering is, why wasn't that a good opportunity to tie in that a lot of our problems that we have in our nation is due to the free trade agreements that we need to stop, and that we also need to reactivate all the regulations that we had from the Depression era?
Well, thanks, Emmanuel. You know, sometimes when you're on a TV show, one of the reasons I love doing the show with Tom, and Tom and I were chatting about it before we went on the air, is you have the opportunity to go into a little bit of length, in a little bit of depth, about some of the important issues. You can't necessarily do that on TV. But you're raising the same question that Mary raised a few moments ago, and it's a very important issue. And what we're talking about here is that for a very long period of time, the way that working class people made it into the middle class, the way they were able to send their kids to college, the way they were able to get a pension, the way they were able to get decent health care benefits, was often with strong unions in the manufacturing sector, producing real products. For a number of reasons, trade being one, automation being the other, we have seen a huge decline in manufacturing in America. In the last 10 years alone, we have seen the loss of 55,000 factories, and over a period of years, we've lost millions and millions of good-paying jobs. Companies have shut down in America. They've gone to China, gone to other developing countries, pay people pennies an hour, and then they bring their products back into this country. So, Manuel, if your question is, do I think that those trade policies have worked, I categorically do not. I think they have failed the American worker, one of the reasons why the middle class is disappearing. My belief is that we have got to demand that corporate America start rebuilding our manufacturing base here if they want us to purchase their products. And if you watch TV tonight, there'll be a million ads there telling you you got to buy this product, you got to buy that product. It's important that we begin to manufacture those products right here in the United States of America. So this is an issue that I've been working on for years. Our difficulty is not only do you have all of corporate America on the other side of this issue, not only do you have the, almost all of the Republicans on the other side of the issue, you have many Democrats as well. So you've had, you know, NAFTA was given to us during the Clinton administration. Ronald Reagan was a strong advocate of unfettered free trade, and so was President Obama. So we have a lot of political work on our hands to address this issue.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. That's a great news source, a lot of fine information. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Peggy in Franksville, Wisconsin, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. My question deals with the gerrymandered districts. In Wisconsin, we had 52% of the population vote Democratic. However, we have both the Assembly and our state Senate is majority Republican, as well as five of our eight federal representatives. And now Scott Walker is talking about possibly splitting up electoral votes. So even though President Obama was elected with over a million votes, they're talking about, well, if this district went for Romney, he should get the vote. And it would have ended up to be like 5-5 for electoral votes. Anyway, so what can we do about this?
Well, Peggy, that's an excellent question, and I wish I had a magical answer. Most of those issues of districts are going to be determined by the states. When they get into racial issues, I think then you're dealing with another issue where the federal government may be able to play a role. But I think there is just no question that the Republicans have been extremely aggressive in the understanding that they really don't have majority support. So through voter suppression, through gerrymandering is not a new concept, but I think the Republicans have taken it perhaps to a new level. So the only answer I have is just within your own state and in other states which have been impacted by that, to just be as aggressive as you can to make sure that people have Democratic representation. If a state is voting overwhelmingly for one party, the other party should not be winning the elections.
Carol in Charlestown, New Hampshire, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. I want to ask Senator Sanders, I heard that disability insurance is going to be running 21% short in 2016, and I'm wondering if he knows anything about this.
I don't know about disability per se, but I do know that Social Security, will pay out all benefits for retirees for the next 21 years, which gives us the time to come up with a formulation and an approach that will make it solvent and strong for the next 50 or 75 years. In terms of how we fund disability benefits, how we fund Social Security benefits, one of the major problems right now, Carol, is there is a cap, there is a cap on the amount of revenue wealthy people contribute into the system. And right now, it's about $113,000. If we lift that cap, we can bring substantially more revenue into the system and make Social Security and disability benefits strong for decades and decades to come. And that's something we must do.
Peter, in Voorheesville, New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you very much, Tom. My question for Senator Sanders, if workers stop going into debt to maintain their standard of living, and therefore the economy would slow down and corporations would have to pay more money to the workers after it slowed down. Since 1972, wages have only gone up $1.36 an hour, whereas wages for the rich, the 1%, is 275%. So that's my question, and I ask myself this simple thing. Before I buy something, will it sell in my yard sale? And that usually ends the sale. Thank you very much, and I'll wait for your answer.
Okay. Thanks, Peter. Thank you. All right. Peter makes, I think the main point that Peter is making is that real wages for millions and millions of American workers has gone down over the last number of decades. He is right in saying, and it's a sad point to have to make, 1973, Tom, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think 1973 was the year, taking inflation into account, where workers' wages in this country were the highest, and it's been downhill since then. Does that sound right to you?
It does. It was in the 70s. I thought it was a little later, but it's in that area, absolutely.
And Peter's point is that since then, taking inflation into account, real wages have gone down. And in recent years, what happened, in order to maintain a middle-class lifestyle, two important things happened. And Peter refers to one of them, and that is workers had to borrow substantial sums of money. They went into debt. And the second way that workers and families maintained their lifestyle, their standard of living, was women entered the workforce in very large numbers and were working very, very long hours. So in general, the way that is the way that working class people maintained their standard of living. And clearly what we would much prefer to see and what we've got to fight for is decent wages in this country. It gets back to the fact that we have to create millions and millions of jobs. And I think you can do that by rebuilding our infrastructure. It gets back to the issue that several callers just today have raised, and that is the need to make fundamental changes in our trade policy so that companies are not throwing American workers out on the street, moving abroad. And the situation is so bad in manufacturing that while in some areas there's been a slight uptick in the number of manufacturing jobs, many of those new jobs are now paying substantially less than workers in factories used to make. So we're getting some new jobs, but those jobs are paying a fraction of what the older jobs used to pay. So in this country today, we have a jobs crisis. We have almost 15% of our workers unemployed or underemployed. That number is higher for people of color. Number is higher for young workers. We have an income crisis. Median family income has gone down by over $3,000 in the last 10 years. Millions and millions of workers today are working longer hours for lower wages. Older workers, in some cases, having lost good-paying jobs, are now working for half the wages that they used to receive. That is the economic crisis in America. And you throw that into the fact that while the middle class disappears and we have a record number of people living in poverty, people on top are doing phenomenally well, and we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, worse here than any time since 1928. So Peter raises the right question, and those are the issues that we have to address. Is deficit reduction important? Yes, it is. But what's even more important is rebuilding the economy for working families, so that when our kids go out to get a job, that it can earn, they can earn a living wage and a decent income.
Matt in Bryan, Ohio, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. My question is, do you think that there would possibly be some legislation, or somebody would possibly like push some legislation for something similar to the Marcora law? Do you know about the Marcora law?
I don't. Can you explain it briefly?
From the brief explanation that I was given is basically that it states that the top paid person in a corporation is only allowed to make 6.5% more than the lowest paid person.
Okay.
And it's actually a law in somewhere in Spain, I believe.
Okay.
It's actually in the law books.
Okay. The likelihood of passing something like that in the United States Congress is next to zero. As I think Tom and I have talked about many times, and I think many of the listeners understand, to a very significant degree, you have a Republican Party and a Republican House of Representatives who see their main function in life is to protecting the wealthiest people and the largest corporations and their big campaign contributors. And you got a Democratic Party, which has some great people who are fighting for working families and some people who, in some ways, are not all that different from Republicans. So what Matt is raising is the question of why it is that in America we have a situation today where CEOs of major corporations are earning hundreds of times what their workers are making. This is a reasonably new phenomenon. I mean, obviously, CEOs and the bosses always made more than workers. But the gap now between the CEO and the average employee has just escalated over the years. And it's not only salary, it's stock options, it's retirement plans, it's golden parachutes. It is all kinds of benefits which the CEOs get. So you see situations where CEOs in some cases are busy figuring out how they can cut back on the pension plans of their workers while at the same time they're giving themselves phenomenal pension plans and golden parachutes. So, you know, the issue of how you can bring more equality into the corporate world is a good, is a very important issue. There are ways to try to do that. But Matt, the kind of idea you proposed is not going to happen in this country in the near future. That's for sure.
Bernie, just a half a minute to the break. Might a piece of that be to reverse the policy that Reagan put into place that let CEOs be paid with stock before Reagan? That was a practice that was pretty much outlawed in our tax code.
Well, I think there are a number of ways you can approach it. For example, you can create a situation where if salaries are above a certain amount, it cannot be deducted by the company for tax purposes, for example.
Yeah. It's our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting for Brunch with Bernie. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. They put a lot of work into keeping that a great news source. It's really worth
checking out. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, of course, at TomHartman.com, you can pick up our new iPhone and iPad app for the show. Plus, you can participate in our message boards, all kinds of cool stuff. It's virtually all free. Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. It's the Tom Hartman Program, our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls. Jim in Citrus Heights, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, thank you for having me. With the polarization of Washington, I think it's time for a higher standard for our congressmen. Do you think it would be possible for all congressmen, both the House and the Senate, to have required 10 years of tax returns in order to be elected?
Required, no. But if, you know, very often in campaigns, people raise that question and candidates, including myself, make that information available. But I wouldn't say required, no.
Okay. Larry, in Pulaski, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello.
Hey, Larry, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Two of my heroes here. I have a comment about Social Security.
Could you relate to the people out there and about the cost of living? They're talking about abolishing that. That is so dangerous, because if people would just close their eyes for a second and think, if they've done away with the cost of living, think about what they were getting when they went on it and what they're getting now. Like me, I'm 73 now. And just do the math. If I'd be getting Social Security what I got when I retired, it would be thousands of dollars. So this idea about Social Security, the people that's on it now, it won't affect them. That's baloney. That will affect you. Could you relate that message out there to the people?
Right. Larry, you're absolutely right. Let me just briefly repeat what the story is. What exists right now is, by law, the government increases Social Security benefits. It's called a cost of living adjustment, a COLA, every year based on inflation. The theory is that if a senior is spending 4% more on medicine, on drugs, on food, on heating, transportation, whatever it is, if his or her costs have gone up by 4%, they will see a 4% increase in their Social Security benefits. That's called a COLA. Now, the question is, how do you determine inflation? How do you determine it? It's harder than it appears at first blush. What the advocates of a so-called chain CPI want, who want to reduce Social Security benefits, this is what they are saying. They're saying that the current formulation is too generous, that we're giving too much money to seniors in COLAs, that we're not taking into consideration, for example, that if the cost of beef went up, seniors would get chicken. If the cost of chicken went up, seniors could eat dog food or whatever it may be. I think that that is just a very bogus argument. I would argue, and many economists would join me, in saying that because seniors spend a heck of a lot of their money on health care needs, on prescription drugs, on heating, those costs have gone up a lot faster than general inflation. For example, if you want to buy a computer, a laptop, the cost of a laptop has gone down in recent years. But most people who are 75 or 80 are not buying laptops, they're buying prescription drugs, which have gone up. So I believe that the current formulation is inadequate. It's not that it's not too generous, it is inadequate. We got to raise it. But there are others who want to cut it. If you cut it, let's be clear, its impact would be immediate. If you are 65 today, by the time you are 75, when you're 75, you would see about $600 a year less than you're currently receiving. And if you're trying to live on $15,000 a year, which many Social Security retirees are, that is a big bite, big bite. And if you're 85, when you go to 85, it'll be over $1,000 a year less. So I am doing my best to take on all of the Republicans, some of the Democrats who want to move to the so-called chain CPI and cut benefits not only for retirees and people on disability, but also disabled veterans.
Reginald in Houston, Texas. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, yes, sir. The banks have been paying back this $10 billion penalties and fines for misappropriation of funds. I wonder if that $10 billion fine that they're paying is going to go directly to the people, or it's going to go into the government coffers, or it's going directly to people. And this is the direct result of Elizabeth Warren being on a banking committee.
Well, I think the money right now, Reginald, will go into the government, and it's the government's job to demand that people who are ripped off by banks in illegal ways are made whole. So I think as it stands now, the money is going into the government.
Okay. And Paul in San Francisco, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. We're about 2 minutes out from the end of the show, or the end of the hour.
Hello, Senator Sanders. And Tom, I'm calling because I'm concerned about the post office, and I have recently signed a petition, petitions.whitehouse.gov, that's urging the president to urge Congress to repeal the 2006
Good.
Postal Accountability Enhancement Act.
Yep.
I'm calling just to find out if that's something that you would support.
Paul, let me tell you, it's an issue that I have worked on very, very hard. And in fact, helped to write a halfway decent bill that passed the Senate, which did address the issue. The main problem, not a lot of people know this, and I think Paul does know it, and that is the major financial crisis facing the post office is that as a result of congressional legislation in 2006, they are asked to come up with $5 billion every single year for future retiree health benefits. That is a huge sum of money. It is unprecedented in the government, unprecedented in the private sector, probably unprecedented in the world. Right now, the fund that is available for future postal retirees' health care needs is fully developed. It has over $40 billion in the fund. So what we did in the Senate bill is, for all intent and purposes, create a situation where the Postal Service will not have to come up with that $5 billion every single year. What we also did is preserve post offices all over the country from being shut down and distribution plants as well.
And great stuff. So, Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this week, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Okay, my pleasure, Bob. Take care. Bye.
Thank you. Senator Bernie Sanders, be sure to check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. When we come back, I'm going to tell you a story that's going to make anybody who, well, it's going to make your head explode.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the second hour of our program. I want to share with you something that you don't know. And I think I can say this with some certainty because I'm pretty knowledgeable about what's going on around America and what people are thinking and what people think our history is. And I didn't know this. And this is just, you're going to find this amazing. So just hang on for the next, you know, 5, 6, 8 minutes here. Let me share this with you. First of all, we've got this whole Second Amendment thing going on, right? This whole general craziness. And the kind of accidentally, Larry Ward, the chairman of Gun Appreciation Day, brought what I'm going to share with you into sharp relief on CNN today. He was being interviewed, and here's what he had to say. This is a pro-gun guy.
If African Americans had been given the right to keep and bear arms from day one of the country's founding, perhaps slavery might not have been a chapter in our history.
Now, you know, that's an absurd premise because African Americans were brought here as slaves and kept in slavery, so there's not a relationship between the two. Slaves, by definition, don't have guns. But he's actually getting really close to the real truth of the Second Amendment. And again, a tip of the hat, I mentioned this yesterday to Shano, our associate producer here, who shared with me Carl T. Bogus's, Dr. Bogus, this is really his name, B-O-G-U-S, Roger Williams University School of Law, associate professor, his book, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment, which I read in its entirety today, and I pulled out about, 15, 20 pages of excerpts, and I wanted to share with some of this with you. This is why there was a Second Amendment. 1787, the Constitution was written. 1788, it was being sold to the states, and the states were having meetings to decide whether or not to ratify it. It was ultimately ratified in 1789, and then in 1789, 91, the amendments were added to it, the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights. So that's the timeline. So in June of 1778, in Richmond, Virginia, the delegates of Virginia got together to decide whether or not they were going to vote for this Constitution, which one of their own, James Madison, was out aggressively promoting. And they had some concerns, and there were people from other states who were visiting as well, and in fact many of the southern states were kind of talking to each other about this at the time, and here is I just want to share some quotes from these meetings that were happening in 1788. The actual people, the actual legislators. The first is from Pierce Butler of South Carolina. He said, the security the southern states want is that their Negroes not be taken from them, which some gentlemen within or without doors have a very good mind to do. In other words, he's talking about slavery. The states were concerned that the Constitution would allow the northern states to end slavery in the southern states. William L. Smith of South Carolina, he said, if these amendments are adopted, they will go a great way in preventing Congress. Now, here he's talking about the Second Amendment. Because the Second Amendment, in fact, actually, in a way, I'm giving you the closing argument on this before I'm giving you the argument. But basically, here's the argument in a nutshell. The Second Amendment was put into place to preserve slavery for the South. That's why it's there. And William L. Smith of South Carolina, one of the delegates, he said, if these amendments are adopted, they will go a great way in preventing Congress from interfering with our Negroes after 20 years. Keep in mind, the Constitution actually ended the importation of slaves in 1808 and said no more taxes on slaves in 1808. The founders, the people who wrote it, actually thought that that would end slavery in 1808, which is basically 20 years after 1888. It's 30 years, actually, I think. But in any case, he says, if these amendments are adopted, it could go a great way in preventing Congress from interfering after 20 years. Otherwise, they may even, within the 20 years, by strained construction of some power, embarrass us very much. In other words, end slavery. The Revolution had changed America because the northern states were banning slavery like there was no tomorrow. The Americans had embraced this all men are created equal idea on which we based our slavery. In fact, Dr. Samuel Johnson, who was from the North and was anti-slavery, he made the comment, how is it that the loudest yelps for liberty come from the drivers of slaves? Vermont had banned slavery in 1777, even though they were not yet a state. Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and New York all enacted gradual legislation of slavery in 1777, 1778. Two prominent citizens of New York founded a group called the New York Society for Promoting the Manumission of Slaves, the liberation of slaves. The first two presidents of the group were first John Jay, our first Supreme Court justice and one of the authors of the Constitution, and then secondly, Alexander Hamilton. Southerners were very, very worried that the Northerners were going to blow up the slave business. And this is, now here's a quote from the book, this book, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment by Carl Bogus. He said, Virginia was a state living in perpetual fear. Fully 44% of Virginia's total population was black, and in some areas, particularly in the eastern part of the state, blacks constituted the majority. Whites were ever mindful that if the right opportunity presented itself, blacks might cut their heads off. This is not hyperbole. On a Sunday morning in September 1739, for example, a group of about 20 blacks broke into a store near Stono, South Carolina, for guns and powder. They decapitated the two white storekeepers, displaying their heads on the front steps, and then headed south, sacking and burning homes and killing whites on their way. They marched while flying banners, beating drums, and calling out liberty to attract more slaves to the rebellion. According to one account, their numbers increased, quote, increased every minute by new Negroes coming to them so that they were above 60, some say 100, end quote. But for a coincidence, the rebellion may have grown considerably larger and perhaps even succeeded. But by chance, the lieutenant governor of South Carolina rode within eyesight of the rebel group on his way to Charleston with four other men. As best events can be reconstructed, that lieutenant governor raced to a Presbyterian church in Willtown, which was in the midst of Sunday services. This was white planters. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, somewhere between 20 and 100 armed and mounted militiamen attacked the rebel group. About 44 blacks and 21 whites died in the ensuing battle. As a warning against future insurrections, the militia decapitated black rebels and placed their heads, quote, up at every milepost they came to, end quote. So, you know, everyone in the South knew the story of the Stonewall Rebellion. In fact, it wasn't just one. One researcher identified over 250 rebellions, each involving more than 10 slaves. One scholar noted slavery was not only an economic and industrial system, but more than that, it was a giant police system. And the basic instrument of control was called the slave patrol, also referred to as the militia. These militia patrols made sure that blacks were not wandering where they did not belong, gathering in groups, or engaging in suspicious activity. Virginia, South Carolina, and Georgia all had well-regulated slave patrols. By the mid-1700s, the patrols had become the responsibility of the militia. Georgia passed laws in 1755 and 1757, for example, carefully dividing militia districts into discrete patrol areas. The Georgia laws required patrols to examine every plantation every month and authorized the patrols, the militias, to search, quote, all Negro houses for offensive weapons and ammunition and to apprehend and give 20 lashes to any slave found outside plantation grounds. And South, and end quote. In other words, in the South, these patrols to stop slave rebellions were the militia. Now I'm going to explain to you after the break how James Madison changed the Second Amendment to go from for the security of a free nation to the security of a free state to satisfy Georgia and Virginia. Right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The Second Amendment was put into place to preserve slavery for the southern states and get them to sign on to ratifying the Constitution. Period. End full stop. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. In nationwide, now, the argument is made, well, you know, all Americans had guns. All white Americans, anyway, had guns, and that was a fine thing. Again, back to this book by Professor Carl T. Bogus, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment. In reality, few Americans owned guns, he writes. The frontier areas of New England and western Pennsylvania, the years 1765 to 1790, they did a detailed search of the records of what people owned, what they left to their heirs and things. And this went down to things like broken teacups, you know, list of personal property. And what they found was that 14% of the household inventories included firearms, and 53% of those guns were listed as not working. In addition, few Americans hunted. Bellensales writes, quote, from the time of the earliest colonial settlements, frontier families relied on Indians or professional hunters for wild game, and the colonial assemblies regulated all forms of hunting. So it's not like this country was birthed in everybody owning a gun. It was fairly rare, except in the South, where the white militia was used to terrorize African-American slaves. Patrick Henry and George Mason were the leaders of the Anti-Federalist movement. Patrick Henry of Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death fame was a big supporter of slavery, ironically. And he gave a speech at the Constitutional Convention in which he was very, very concerned that Article 1, Section 8, the powers given to the federal government, could be used to subvert the slave system. And that the way that this would happen, and what he was seeing was exactly, by the way, what Abraham Lincoln did, was that the federal government, under the powers given them in Article 1, Section 8, if there was a war, they could call slaves out of the South into military service and free them, and thus bring about the end of slavery in the South. In fact, here is his actual speech. He said, and this was, you know, in the debate about whether or not, again, Virginia should sign up for the Constitution. Quote, in this state, there are 236,000 blacks, and there are many in several other states, but there are few or none in the northern states. Under its power to provide for the general defense, Congress might enlist blacks into the army and then emancipate them. Slavery is detested in the North. They will search that paper, that being the Constitution, and see if they have the power of manumission, that is, freeing the slaves. And have they not, sir? Have they not power to provide for the general defense and welfare? May they not think that these call for the abolition of slavery? May they not pronounce all slaves free? And will they not be warranted by that power? This is no ambiguous implication or logical deduction. The paper, the Constitution, speaks to the point. They have the power. It would be the federal government if we ratify the Constitution. They have the power in clear, unequivocal terms and will clearly and certainly exercise it. He went on to say, a decided majority of states have not the ties of sympathy and fellow feeling for those whose interests would be affected. In other words, most of the states didn't, you know, they weren't all that hot about the slavery in the South. He says, the majority of Congress is to the North and the slaves are to the South. End of quote from Patrick Henry. About why, if they were, what he was saying is, if we're going to ratify this Constitution, we have to amend it to say that the militias in the South that ride the circuit, that they're basically like neighborhood watches, and they're armed, that their right to carry weapons will not be taken away. Now, James Madison responded to Patrick Henry. 20 minutes after Henry gave that speech, James Madison stood up and said, I was struck with surprise when I heard him express himself alarm with respect to the emancipation of slaves. There is no power to warrant it in that paper, in the Constitution. If there be, I know it not. End of quote from James Madison. But that being the case, Madison had proposed a Second Amendment, which said that the people have a right to keep and bear arms, that a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state, that standing armies in times of peace are dangerous to liberty and therefore ought to be avoided as far as the circumstances and protection of the community will admit, and that in all cases the military should be under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. That no standing army or regular troops shall be raised or kept up in time of peace without the consent of two-thirds of the member presence of both houses. That each state respectively shall have the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining its own militia. That the militia shall not be subject to martial law except in time of war. Then he modified that to say the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. A well-armed and well-regulated militia being necessary for the best security of a free country. This was the ultimate first draft of the Second Amendment. But no person religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service. Madison then changed that in response to Patrick Henry to change it from being the best security of a free country to the best defense of a free state. Now, why was he saying the best defense of a free state? Because the states in the South defended themselves by, you know, again, let me make this very, very clear what the militia did in the South. 1755, 1757, for example, Georgia carefully divided militia districts into discrete patrol areas. They required patrols under the direction of commissioned militia, state militia officers, to examine every plantation each month and authorize them to search all Negro houses for offensive weapons and ammunition and apprehend and give 20 lashes to any slave found outside plantation grounds. The militia were the ones who enforced slavery in the South. And to defend that right to have slavery in a free state, not a free country, a free state, the Second Amendment was put into place. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So try running that by your favorite gun nut. And by the way, I think that we're seeing the same thing. It's all about, oh, all this Chicago crime. Well, come on, this is code for black. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, let me just say it in plain language. The Second Amendment, let me back up a little bit. The principal way that slavery was maintained in the South, this kind of brings you back to Django. The principal way that slavery was maintained in the South, because in Django, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio famously asked the question, why don't they just rise up and kill us? Well, he knew the answer. Or at least a person of his time knew the answer. Quentin Tarantino might not have known the answer, but the answer is very simple. there were, every state had militias, and the job, and the militias were made up of volunteers. In fact, Georgia law required every plantation owner, including female plantation owners, to be members of the militia, and the militia to do monthly patrols. Now, they did daily patrols as well. But the monthly patrols had to literally inspect every slave quarter in the entire state. The homes of every slave, the sleeping quarters of every slave in the state. And these were called militias. And they were regulated by the states. The states passed laws that, that regulated how the militias would keep the slaves in line. And this is why there were only a couple of hundred major slave rebellions that were documented in the 16 and 1700s. So, in order to maintain, let me get the exact language here. I find this just absolutely fascinating. James Madison's original draft, his original final draft, his original first draft of the Second Amendment said, you know, basically no standing armies, all this, because there were these two arguments. There were two factions who were making the arguments. There was the Jefferson and people in the North faction who were saying, we don't want standing armies during time of peace, period. So let's have a National Guard. And then there were the Southerners. And they were saying, we have our militia. They'd had them for 200 years. Our militia are the police forces that enforce slavery. That's their primary job. And we do not want them taken away from us. In fact, George, another part of this I could share with you, if we, in fact, we'll come back to it maybe next week, and I'll share a little more of the writings of some of the founders and the speeches. I mean, George Mason stood up and he said, you know, what happens if one of the northern states asks for our militiamen to go up to their state? Couldn't that happen under the Constitution? And so, you know, the reason he was worried about that is if the militia of the state of Georgia had to leave and go up to Massachusetts to deal with an emergency or a war, there'd be nobody to keep the slaves oppressed in Georgia. So the final draft became a well-regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state, not nation, not country. Country was the first draft. It said free country. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And, of course, what they were referring to is the white plantation owners, or at least those in the South were referring to. Now, those in the North had a very different idea in mind, but that's what they were all about in the South. Matt in Hillsboro, Oregon. Hey, Matt. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for watching. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah. Can you hear me all right?
Just fine.
All right. Of course, right now the Second Amendment is a really hot-button topic, and I've been getting into some arguments with friends, of course. I didn't think that there was really any sort of historical context as far as the founders and framers were concerned, supporting the right of people to keep and bear arms for the purpose of posing a threat to the government
No, that was never even on the radar screen. That was never even seriously discussed by anybody. James Madison essentially ridiculed that in one of the Federalist Papers. I think it was Federalist 26. Nobody was suggesting that we should be able to have guns so that we could pull an Alex Jones and repeat 1776, you know, take down the government.
Right. But one of the things that I can't get around is that they'll quote to me, they'll send me references for example, Thomas Jefferson tends to be one of the most off-quoted, and one of the ones that I haven't been able to debunk to find out of context was the letter about Shays' Rebellion that includes the off-quoted Tree of Liberty quote.
Yeah.
And it seems that even in context, there seems to be some sort of at least tacit support for everyone to remain armed to be a check. And I was wondering, you've spent a lot of time studying Jefferson, yeah. So I was wondering what you've seen as far as Jefferson says.
Jefferson actually is quoted at some length in this Hidden History of the Second Amendment that was published first in the UC Davis Law Review in the winter of 1998. And I thought I had separated out. Apparently I hadn't. Here it is, right here. One of his questions, he talks about the modern insurrectionist theory, and he points out Tim McVeigh is an insurrectionist. When he was arrested hours after bombing the federal building, Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, he was wearing a T-shirt emblazoned with the words and pictures of two of the most venerated figures in American history. I'm quoting from Dr. Bogus. On the front was Abraham Lincoln, who more than any other American symbolizes the permanence and strength of the Union. And he was portrayed on a wanted poster, and under his picture were the words that John Wilkes Booth shouted as he shot Lincoln, "Sic Semper Tyrannis," in other words, death to the tyrants. And on the back of the shirt was a tree with droplets of blood instead of leaves, and the words of Thomas Jefferson, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants." McVeigh also, when Waco was going on, he traveled there to sell bumper stickers. One said, "Fear the government that fears your guns." And another said, "Ban guns, make the streets safe for a government takeover." This was Tim McVeigh. So the question is, were the founders insurrectionists? And here's what the professor has to say about this. With few exceptions, first of all, he makes a detailed argument that at two points in his life, Thomas Jefferson arguably was an insurrectionist. He actually said, and Shays' Rebellion is the example, that, you know, sometimes a revolution against the government is not a bad thing. It shakes things up and good things can come out of that. After the French Revolution, Jefferson stopped talking like that. And after the French Revolution, Jefferson became president of the United States. He definitely stopped talking like that. Yeah, he became the establishment.
Where can I go specifically to find anything as far as when the Constitution was being written? Where can I cite specifically to refute these positions?
I would have to go back and look at that. Here's what Dr. Bogus said. He said, with few exceptions, the founders were never insurrectionists in the sense that they believed the people should take matters into their own hands by force of arms. Gary Wills notes that even as late as 1775, John Adams denied that the Continental Congress was engaging in rebellion. This is a quote from John Adams, who, you know, edited the Declaration of Independence that Thomas Jefferson wrote. He said, quote, "The people of this continent have the utmost abhorrence of treason and rebellion." He argued that they were engaged in revolution, not rebellion, which is a very different thing. Rebellion is a riot against your own state. Revolution is against a foreign state. And in fact, to again quote this article, John Adams associated the word revolution, derived from astronomy, with ordered and prescribed movement, and these men considered themselves engaged in an orderly and legally justified endeavor. And in fact, if you go back and you read the Declaration of Independence, what you will find is that it's a declaration of revolution, not rebellion. And it's a legal document, because basically what Jefferson lays out in the Declaration of Independence is the list of grievances, the violations of law and human rights that the King of England, King George II, had been engaged in, and that justified their throwing off that old guard, to paraphrase the Declaration of Independence, to you know, prepare for the new guard, to create their own country. So no, most of the founders, virtually all the founders, were not insurrectionists like Tim McVeigh was. They didn't view themselves as throwing off their own government. They viewed themselves as pushing out a foreign government. They were engaged in revolution, not rebellion, if that makes sense. Thanks a lot for the call, Matt. Aaron in Houston, Texas. Hey, Aaron, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tom, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay,
do people ask me that because you have a hard time hearing me when I put you on the air?
Yeah, I just want to make sure, because there's no click in my headset. But, yeah, I just wanted to talk about some of the debate in gun control about banning assault rifles, and what is an assault rifle, and the difference between an assault rifle and a hunting rifle.
Right.
And there's a lot of confusion that can hit people about what the difference is. No, they're not that much different between hunting rifles and the like. And it's important to remember, I've been doing some research on that, with a hunting rifle, they are extremely powerful. They can hit animals from very long range away, sometimes very big animals, very powerful. But with an assault rifle, the thing about them is that they have a recoil mechanism as well as a trigger mechanism that specifically allows them to be to deliver sustained fire without that much recoil.
Right.
And that's why they're...
Well, and the other big difference is that an assault weapon, you can put a high-capacity clip in, and you can't do that with a hunting rifle.
Right. That is.
I think that's the most significant difference.
Well, the ability there is, but also the ability to just sort of maintain a certain amount of sustained fire at a relatively, target,
Right, without burning your hand on the stock, and I think you're right. Assault weapons are designed, well, they're weapons of war. They're designed for that, and you don't need, to fire off 30 rounds to take out a deer. Thank you, Aaron, for the call. In fact, there was a cartoon that I saw today. That showed this guy coming home, with his assault weapon over his shoulder saying, honey, I'm back from hunting and I got a deer, and he's holding like a foot. And that's all that's left, The rest of the deer has been vaporized.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But I think this for me was a major revelation. I started out saying, you don't know this. I'm guessing you didn't. You do now. Spread the word. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Let's check in on the news with Victoria Jones and the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a photo of that goat and that former slave. GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Victoria, what's going on in the world?
Hey, Tom. Well, President Obama and President Karzai of Afghanistan met today. Then they had a joint press availability, at which they said that they've agreed to speed up slightly the schedule for moving Afghanistan security forces into the lead across the country. In other words, the Afghans take control and the U.S. moves into a support role.
Which is what we're doing in Iraq right now, is it not?
Yes.
It basically means the war could end in the next few months.
It could. It could.
Would that it would.
That would now take place this spring. It had previously been scheduled to take place this summer.
That's remarkable. Well, let's hope that the president can pull this off. I think that the fact that there's been, other than John McCain sputtering, there's been basically no outcry about this. Rachel Maddow talked about this on her TV show last night. I thought it was an excellent point. Is an indication that the country, if President Obama were tomorrow to say, okay, that's it, we're out of Afghanistan, the country's with him, including the Republicans.
I have to tell you, the Republican hosts I talked to, they want out now.
I think everybody is sick of war, enough killing already.
Yeah, I think they're sick of it, and I think most people accept that the country's probably going to revert.
The country of Afghanistan is going to go back to the Taliban. Yeah. In fact, they're meeting with the Taliban in Doha right now.
Yeah. Well, one of the things they've also agreed to do is they called on the Taliban to open an office in Doha, an idea that's been discussed for more than a year, but never so officially, to better facilitate peace talks.
Right. So this would be like the IRA having an outside office, in the UK, so that they could have, so Gerry Adams could have conversations with Margaret Thatcher, or the PLO having an office so that Yasser Arafat could have conversations with Menachem Begin.
Exactly. Yeah. In other words, as Winston Churchill used to say, jaw is better than war.
Jaw, J-A-W, as in talk. Yeah,
yes.
I totally agree. And he was certainly a man who would know.
He knew. Yeah. President Obama will deliver the State of the Union address to Congress on February the 12th. Quite late.
Mm-hmm.
Things he's being inaugurated on the 20th and 21st of January. Speaker Boehner wrote to him today saying our nation continues to face immense challenges. The American people expect us to work together to find meaningful solutions. This will require willingness to seek common ground as well as presidential leadership, saying that welcome an opportunity to hear your plan and specific solutions for addressing America's great challenges.
I thought it was really interesting that we didn't know until just very recently when he was going to do the State of the Union, and now it looks like it's going to be timed to a week or so before the debt ceiling thing just totally explodes, which is going to maximize the impact he will have of that bully pulpit of the State of the Union address.
Yes, it's interesting. I think he will use the inaugural address to address gun violence.
Perhaps, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, typically the inaugural address is the grand soaring visionary things, and the State of the Union address is where there's, okay, here's some nuts and bolts stuff we got to deal with.
Right, and I think that that will be more of a fiscal speech.
Right.
Although I think that he will deal with a lot of other issues. I think he'll deal with immigration. I think he'll hone in again on gun violence and many other. It'll be a laundry list. It always is. Mm. But I do think that he is going to address gun violence in his inaugural address.
Very interesting.
I think he is.
I'd bet.
Very interesting story out of the State Department. The State Department's throwing its weight behind controversial Securities and Exchange Commission rules that will force oil, gas, and mining companies to disclose payments to foreign governments.
Whoa.
Now, these are rules finalized last August and that are required under the Dodd-Frank financial law, but they drew a legal challenge from oil industry and business groups like the American Petroleum Institute and the Chamber of Commerce. They say the mandate will impose costly burdens.
Yeah.
And the State Department...
They're going to have to hire an extra lawyer to put together the disclosure document. Gee.
Yeah. Now, the disclosures basically force SEC-listed oil, natural gas, and mining companies to reveal payments to governments, including the U.S. government, related to projects in their countries, such as money for production licenses, taxes, royalties, and other aspects of energy and mineral projects. The idea is to increase transparency to help undo what's called the resource curse,
yeah,
in which some poor countries in Africa and other places are plagued by high levels of corruption and conflict alongside their energy and mineral wealth.
Well, and not to mention the United States. Before the Reagan administration, the average lease price for oil and gas lands in the United States was around $2,300 an acre. And then James Watt came in and dropped it down to a little over $200 an acre. In other words, dropped it slashed it by 9/10, and which is where it stands today, by and large. And so, you know, we are 93rd in the world in terms of how much revenue we get from the big oil companies relative to the money that they're raking in from what they take out of the ground.
That is an astonishing fact.
When James Watt was confronted about that when he was the Secretary of Interior during the Reagan administration, he said, it does, I'm paraphrasing, but you can find the exact quote. He said, it doesn't matter how much money we get. It doesn't matter what they do to the land, because Jesus is coming soon and he's going to make all things new. I'm not making this up.
Okay.
So anyhow, so I think some transparency is a great idea.
Yes. Well, American Petroleum Institute, Chamber of Commerce, and two other groups who challenge it also say that the mandate runs afoul of the First Amendment by compelling U.S. companies to engage in costly speech on controversial matters in order to influence political affairs in other nations.
Yes, now that Scalia has said that they're people, they want to push that First Amendment thing as hard as they can. That's insane. That's incredible.
I think the State Department said that's rubbish.
Yes, yes. Rubbish would be a charitable term. Victoria Jones, thank you so much, Victoria.
Thank you.
TalkRadioNews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. It's Anything Goes Friday. And so, although I'll grant you, the second hour, first hour was Bernie. The second hour was my half hour rant on how the militias in the South were, you know, they over time, they morphed into the KKK. The KKK of the late 1800s, the post-Civil War KKK, was what was referred to as the militias in the 1700s and early 1800s. They would, you know, ride from plantation to plantation, put down slave rebellions, make sure that slaves were not running away, and, you know, look for any signs of slaves that represented a threat to the order, as it were. Or, for that matter, you know, white people who represented a threat to the order, who might be taking the side of the slaves. Tor in Landers, California. Hey, Tor, you wanted to talk about revolutions and rebellions.
How you feeling, Tom?
Very well, thank you. What's up?
Yeah, a rebellion and a revolution are not about a place of origin. A rebellion it means it failed. It didn't work. A revolution means it was successful. So if you have a rebellion that's successful, it becomes a revolution.
That's an interesting point. The point that Professor Bogus makes is that in 1776, the word revolution was believed to, because, you know, we still refer to the French Revolution as the French Revolution, although it ultimately failed. But the word revolution was viewed as something that was orderly and legal because it came, the word came out of the revolutions of the earth around the sun, the, you know, astronomy, basically. And so our meaning today may be somewhat different than it was in 1776. But insurrection, really, I guess, versus revolution.
Well, the dictionary defines them both as insurrection.
But. Yeah, see, and but 230 years ago, insurrection was viewed as something very different. And in fact, I mean, insurrection was rising up against your own government. And while Jefferson was arguably at two different times in his life an insurrectionist, he played no role whatsoever in writing the Second Amendment, in proposing the Second Amendment, in ratifying the Second Amendment. He had nothing to do with it. He demanded that there be a Bill of Rights. And in his correspondence with Madison in 1789, when Madison first sent him the Constitution, the first draft of the Constitution, he sent back a letter saying, you know, here's what I like about it, and here's what I will tell you what I do not like. That's verbatim from Jefferson. And he said, you know, that there needs to be without artifice and without ambiguity, there needs to be a clear statement of the rights of, you know, a Bill of Rights. And he wanted that Bill of Rights to include that there would be no standing armies during time of peace, that there would be no monopolies in business, that there would be an absolute right of personal privacy. They didn't use that word back then because privacy back then meant I need to use the toilet, thus privies. I need some privacy is what somebody would say, which was I need to, you know.
And a quick question, Tom.
Yeah, go ahead.
When is the Senate going to vote on this, discuss the filibuster? When does that happen?
It is going to be when the Senate comes back into session, the first day of the first session, which will probably be the day after the president is sworn in, the inauguration.
The 21st.
Yeah, so he's sworn in on Monday, which is, I think, the 21st. And so it would probably be Tuesday. I don't think that there's going to be a session of Congress that day, but I could be wrong. I'm not a congressional calendar watcher, so the folks who track that really well are the folks over at Daily Kos. Tor, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah,
I appreciate it. Jerry in Amityville, New York, listening on WWRL. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, what's up? Well, with respect to the Second Amendment and the right to keep and bear arms, what's so often missing from the discussion, what I'd like to bring to discussion, is the fact that no right is absolute, not even the First Amendment, and even someone as conservative as Justice Scalia, he acknowledged this publicly, both in a landmark Supreme Court decision on the Second Amendment, and also he's acknowledged just publicly in interviews, he's acknowledged the fact that the Second Amendment is not absolute, and there can't be reasonable limitations or restrictions placed on it. Sure. So that leads me to my next point. I think that America, therefore, has a clear choice between common-sense reasonable firearms regulations, such as rebanning semi-automatic military-style assault weapons with high-capacity ammunition clips, as Dianne Feinstein wants to do, and the other choice, and we have a choice between that and the absolutist, poorly thought out, and extremist view and suggestions of people like NRA Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre, who seems to want to ignore the harm done by guns, and ironically he suggests that more guns in more people's hands is the magic answer to America's gun violence problem. And we have a recent shooting out in California yesterday that shows the folly of his whole idea that if you send armed guards or armed policemen to schools, you prevent any of these armed young people from coming into the schools with a gun. There was a 16-year-old that came into a California school yesterday with a gun, and it was not a It was not an armed teacher or an armed guard who stopped them. What stopped them was a teacher who was unarmed and helped talk him out of using the gun any further than he already had.
Well, and I think one of the significant differences between that student and the student who committed this horrible crime in Connecticut was that student was not suicidal. He was homicidal. He had been bullied and he was looking to exact revenge, as opposed to trying to kill himself and go out in a blaze of glory. So, and we don't know if he was on meds, and we don't know what the situation is. But your point that there are no absolute rights granted in the Constitution, I think, is very well taken, and the Supreme Court has consistently agreed with the jury. Absolutely, no pun intended. Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'd like to bring up a point that all these people say limiting capacity clips, high capacity clips, wouldn't work. Well, the shooter yesterday had a shotgun, and it had a plug in, and it only had 3 rounds. So he shot 2 people, and then he looked at the teacher and said, "I don't want to shoot you," blew out the window, set the gun down, and it was over.
Right.
That's why that shooting wasn't horrific. And they had an armed guard there, and if somebody actually saw the student walk into the school, according to the CBS story I read last night, that's why that shooting wasn't worth, because they had only 3 bullets.
Because the guy had a hunting rifle, and it was limited to 3 bullets. Yeah.
That was it, because in California, when you go duck hunting, you have to have a plug in your gun, so you're only allowed to have 3 rounds.
Right, the duck
gun. So he stole some hunting rifle, some hunting shotgun. He had 3 rounds, didn't want to shoot the teacher, blew out the window, set the gun down on the table. This is according to the CBS News story I read yesterday about it.
Right.
So,
yeah. Yeah, I got it. I got it, Paul. And it is evidence that, you know, if these high capacity clips were not available, and I think it's possible for us to make things not available by law, that these kind of horrific events. Joel in Wilmette, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Joel, we got a minute to the break. It's yours.
Hi. Thanks for the history lesson today. It's very interesting. I just had an idea to bounce off you about one reason why Americans are so hostile about paying taxes, and it might be the way it's structured on paychecks. And when people get their first job, per se, being paid $10 an hour, and they get their paycheck and it's $273, it seems it might be more productive if the employer basically calculated all the taxes owed and negotiated a wage that would be, say, $6.50 or $7 an hour, and the employee never really saw a reduction of taxes out of their paychecks, but could see a statement of the amount that the employer is paying towards all the taxes.
Well, you're talking about the you know, moving down the line. Originally, when the income tax was put into place, people had to pay it at the end of the year, and they had to tally up everything that they owed and then pay the tax, and that produced a lot of resistance. And that's why I think it was in the 1930s that employer withholding began, and you know, so that people didn't actually have to write a check to the government; their employer did it for them. But you know, interesting point. We'll be back 15 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, and you can drop into our live chat room over at TomHartman.com. Say hi. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, Mark, in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Well, I agree with you 90% of the time.
But!
All right. Now, see, this is it. You know, I was against gun... I was in favor of gun control until I was victimized by crime. Okay? And you know...
Well, wait a second. What are you defining as gun control?
Well, for example, in Chicago, we can't have handguns. Can't conceal and carry handguns.
Sure you can.
You just have to get a license.
Carry
them around. You can own them, but you can't carry them around the street. Okay, they're going to have to remake the law because the Supreme Court knocked it down, but we don't know what it's going to be yet. But see, the thing is this, you know, I mean, the guy who victimized me, he has a record as long as his arm, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And you know, if you threaten him with like arrest or the police, he laughs. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the thing is this, if society or the government, you know, restricts gun ownership, implicit in the bargain is that the state is going to protect you. Okay. Now here in Chicago, because of budget cuts, you know, the police department is down like at least 1,000 members. You know, I mean, there are longer response times and the whole bit. You know, for
well, talk to your Republican and conservative, you know, tax cutting, government cutting local elected officials. Here, I have a question for you, Mark. You're a victim of crime. The fellow who took you on was a professional criminal.
Well, yeah,
Doesn't it make sense that a professional criminal operating in a city where people can fairly easily get a license to carry a concealed firearm would make sure that they approached a potential victim in a way that would render them incapable of accessing their firearm? In other words,
He did it to me in my house. He was somebody I took into my house.
Okay, but my point is that, you know, they would come up behind you and grab your elbows and pull them back so that you can't put your hands into your pocket and pull out your gun. And then, you know, they would assault you or rob you or whatever. I mean, doesn't it make sense that a professional criminal, you know, in an area where there are no guns might feel a little more, you know, bolder and might be a little sloppier. But in an area where there's a lot of guns, they're just going to render you incapable of accessing your gun. And the thing that makes me think this is the statistics that, and one of the problems is we don't know all these statistics because the Republicans in Congress made it illegal for Congress to compile the statistics. But, you know, there's an enormous number of people every year who have a gun with them and they're confronted with a criminal and the criminal takes their gun away from them and uses it against them.
I'd like to answer your question.
Please do.
In tradition, like in places like Chicago, where I am, you know, in the minority areas, the African American Hispanic areas, there are people, you know, tend to carry more guns because traditionally the police, you know, the racist police, the racist city government didn't want to be bothered with protecting them. Those are also hard.
I'm not sure that's true. My understanding is that
it is in fact true. One of the initial movements for gun control was a thinly veiled reaction to the Panthers, to the Black Panthers in the 60s against, you know, who were citing their first Second Amendment rights, and it was the shock and horror of the middle class white people to the Panthers. I mean, that was one of the initial gun control movements.
Right, but the Black Panthers were not average people in average African American neighborhoods. I've known such people. And they're not armed, and their neighbors are not armed, by and large.
African American neighborhoods. I mean, the racist police departments traditionally did not want to be bothered with. The police did not want to risk their lives protecting. They wanted to make sure that the crime just stayed in the African American community and the Hispanic community.
I'm not disagreeing with you on that point.
And as a result, see, you can't tell people they can't protect themselves if the state is going to abdicate its responsibility to protect them.
I'm not disagreeing with that either. So you started out by saying that you disagree with my stance on gun control, and my stance on gun control is very, very simple. We should regulate guns the way we regulate cars. A deadly weapon should be registered just like a car is registered, because we register cars because they can kill people. It should be insured, and the person using it should be insured against liability. Each one of those 20 children who was shot in Newtown, there's no insurance policy that's going to pay, you know, unless their parents had the foresight to buy one, you know, very large life insurance policy for them. There's no insurance policy that's going to, you know, compensate their families for their loss. However, had those kids been killed by somebody driving a car, the car insurance company, if you had Geico or Allstate or whatever, the car insurance company would pay, you know, you have liability insurance. So if you kill a kid with a car, that their family can sue your insurance company and get, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. But if a kid gets killed with a gun, there's nobody to sue except the guy who is wielding the gun, in this case, he's dead. So number two, they should be insured. And number three, the owner of the gun or the person using the gun, both, in fact, if you hand your gun to somebody else, it should be the same thing as if you hand your car to somebody else, should be licensed to use it. And that license procedure should basically be that they've demonstrated that they have proficiency in using that weapon. They know how to use it in a way that's not going to kill them or others. What's wrong with that?
I don't suppose there's much wrong with that. But currently, a lot of poor people who can't rely on the state, you know, and have to protect themselves are being criminalized by it.
I'm not disagreeing with that point, but Mark, you know, you said you disagreed with my position on gun control. I just explained my position on gun control to you. Oh, and I will add, I think weapons of war should not be in civilian hands. I think we need to extend the machine gun ban and the rocket ban and things like that to, you know, high capacity clips and military style weapons. But that said, do you still disagree with me?
No, I don't suppose.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So I just wanted to get that clear. Thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate the call. Okay. This is the thing. The NRA creates this straw man. And this is what they're so good at doing, is that anybody who says even a half a sentence that has the phrase gun control in it wants to take away your guns. I don't want to take away your guns. I don't want to take away your car either. And you can kill me with your car, too. And 50,000 Americans are killed by cars every year, or with cars. You know, half as many as more than are killed with guns. We've got about 30,000 killed with guns, 20,000 suicides, 10,000 murders. But I think that it makes sense to say this is a device that is designed to kill people. So let's keep track of it. Let's ensure it and its users, and let's make sure people using them are proficient. What's wrong with that?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It seems to me like this is just common sense stuff. And as one of the earlier callers said, I think that there's a large subtext of racism in all this, which takes us back to the origins of the Second Amendment. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, Shana was telling me during the break. It's already started. What, was it Newt Gingrich?
They want to destroy the Second Amendment.
No, I don't think so.
Take away our guns.
No, I don't think so. It's like, you know, how about that well-regulated militia to put down slaves? Let's talk about that, Newt. Charles in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Charles.
Calling from Stone Mountain, listening to the WCPT.
Okay, great. What's up?
Yeah, you had made a statement. The gentleman that called talked about how the Panthers, he talked about, and you said they were average people. I didn't understand what you meant by there. The Panthers were very average people.
No, I was differentiating. I said the Black Panthers were, or what I meant to say, I don't recall how it came out of my mouth, but was that the Black Panthers were a specific group. They did not represent, and they were not, if you're going to talk about them, you can't be talking about average African-American middle-class communities, or, you know, that's like saying that Patty Hearst represents average, you know, white middle, upper middle class. Actually, she was rich, but
they were, but that's another argument. Yeah. What I'm trying to make is that there's an article in Griot today, and it talks about how, you know, the NRA was actually for gun control before they were against it. And it talks about how, you know, throughout the history of the NRA, they were really for gun control up until the 1960s. And it lays it out really specific, and you know, you can go deeper into that with research. It talked about how they were after the assassinations of President Kennedy, Dr. King, Bobby, they were into like gun control. But really, what happened was, like you said, 1967, when the Black Panthers, who were under siege by, I'm a 52-year-old black man, grew up in the North, but they were under siege by the power structure. They went into the state capitol and with a gun, protesting their gun rights, and they were protecting the community from the police. Mm-hmm. And of course, President Reagan at that time was for gun control.
Wouldn't have been 63. That would have been 80 in the 80s.
No. He was the governor of California.
Oh, okay.
The Mullen Act.
Okay. Yeah.
Mullen Act. He did that. It was strange because basically it was only for people who lived in metropolitan areas. It wasn't for people who lived in the rural areas.
Right.
So Reagan was for gun control up until the 1970s is when it goes into detail. The head of the NRA, who was an ex Border Patrol guard, was against gun control.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, Reagan became anti-gun control. And he was the first president to be endorsed by the NRA in 1980. And it's ironically, in 1981, he got shot by guns.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's an article, and I posted it on the chat room. And
great.
It's real detailed. You might want to talk about it.
Great.
But it tells you how hypocritical everything is. And the article says that the Black Panthers were the first gun rights group in America. Because they were the first ones to advocate self-protection. And like I said, the Panthers, this guy named Richard Aoki, who was a Japanese, one of the founders of the Black Panthers, and he basically got involved because he was interned during World War II, and he was a Japanese man, educated. He became very disenchanted with the system, and that's how the Black Panthers got started.
I'm going to have to track this down. You've got it in our chat room. Can you also post it to our today's blog on our homepage?
I'll figure it out because I just joined today.
Oh, okay, great. On the homepage, there's I put a blog up every day, and people can comment on it, and that's what I read every night when I get home. And so if you put a link there, I mean, it'll be gone in the chat room during the time that I watch the chat room scrolling by, but I'm on the air, so I can't click on things and jump into things. But if you put it on that blog, it'll be there and it'll stay there. So I'll check it out. Thank you, Charles, for the information. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. And thanks for listening. Jay in Plano, Texas. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First of all, I just agree with you 100% on the fact that people who own firearms definitely need to know how to use them, and I think they should display some sort of proficiency. I'm ex-military, and I own I have a concealed handgun license, and both of those things required me to show proficiency in my weapon.
Yeah. I live on a boat. I have to prove to the Coast Guard that I know how to operate it before they'll let me untie it. I mean,
of course, but the current push and what seems like has the best chance of passing some sort of legislation is limits on capacity. You know, nobody needs more than 10 rounds in their gun. That's what everybody seems to say.
Yeah.
Adam Lanza used 4 handguns. According to MSNBC, he actually never took the AR-15 out of his car.
Well, no, actually, according to the coroner who was there, there were 2 AR-15s. One was left in the trunk. The other he carried in, and most of the shots were from that assault weapon. He was apparently carrying handguns, but most of the killing was done with the assault weapon, with the Bushmaster.
The last one I read was 4 handguns, and my point was going to be that even if he had 4 handguns, if with 10-round capacity, that's 11 bullets per gun if you have one in the chamber.
Right.
That's 44 rounds that, even if, you know, let's fast forward 2 years and this is what's in place, someone like him could have gone in with 4 handguns and had 44 rounds at his disposal.
Right.
It's not so much capacity as it is, well, it's mental capacity more than ammunition capacity.
Well, there is an ammunition limit. I mean, with the guy who tried to assassinate Gabby Giffords, his Waterloo was when his gun jammed and he was trying to eject the high capacity clip and replace it
same in Colorado.
Yeah, in
Colorado, his rounds jammed in his magazine.
Right. And
the point is he could have carried enough ammunition with him to affect a lot of damage even with
I don't disagree with that, Jay. And I think that there are a lot of things that we need to be looking at here and a lot of things we need to be talking about. I think we need to be looking at and talking about the role of some of these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor drugs that we're giving our young people. I think that we need to look at the role of income inequality in the United States. There has to be a reason why we have 2,000% higher gun homicide rates in the United States than any other country in the world, and higher homicide rates in general than on a per capita basis than pretty much certainly than any other developed country, any other equivalent country. That said, we do know that you can just look at the statistics. Those areas of the country that have the highest number of guns have the highest number of gun deaths. Accidental, intentional, homicide, suicide, no matter how you count it, more guns, more gun deaths. And, you know, I would have to assume, although the government has been forbidden for the last 15 years or so, maybe 20 years, because of legislation pushed by a Republican congressman, I have to assume that if you looked at the number of bullets or the capacity of the weapons, you'd probably find a similar correlation. We don't know because the NRA has gotten legislation passed that forbids our government from gathering that information, which seems to me bizarre. And that's what Joe Biden was talking about yesterday. Anyhow, Jay, you made your point very well. Thank you for the call. George in Chicago. Hey, George. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Yeah,
what's
up? Oh, it's the greatest radio station in the country.
It is.
2 points on the Second Amendment. Well, anything that carries Tom Hartman is a great radio station by definition.
Bless you, George.
Anyway, the men who wrote the Constitution were, by and large, pretty well educated and learned. They were conversant with Latin and Greek. They knew the power of words and how important it was to phrase things precisely, and that what was not said was often as important as what was said.
Yes.
And the Second Amendment does not say the right of individual citizens to keep and bear arms shall not be abridged. It doesn't say that.
That's right.
After the article, the operative first word in the amendment is well regulated,
right,
which clearly indicates the passage of legislation that sets rules and laws and standards.
Yes.
But now that you've added the writings of Professor Bogus to the argument, it strikes me that because the Southern delegates were so intent on making sure that this power and this amendment were rooted in the power of individual free states, that would seem to imply to me, a non-lawyer and layman, that each one of the 50 states, by virtue of the phrasing and the background of the Second Amendment, has the right to set their own firearms regulations. What do you think?
I don't disagree. And I don't think that James Madison would disagree. He was the one who, in the first draft, said the right of the free country, and then changed that to a free state. And I think, you know, Virginia, South Carolina, and Georgia were states that explicitly regulated their militias as explicitly in law as slave patrols. And in 1755, 1757, for example, Georgia statutes, and I could track down the exact state, you know, the footnotes to all of this stuff are in Dr. Bogus's article. Carefully divided militia districts into discrete patrol areas and specified when the patrols would muster. The Georgia statutes required patrols under the direction of commissioned militia officers to examine every plantation every month. You know, and they go through right down to the details of how many lashes the slaves got if they were found outside, you know, 20 lashes if they were found outside the property of the plantation. And so, you know, and this was defined by Georgia statute, by Virginia statute, and by South Carolina statute as well-regulated militia. That was the phrase, the phraseology used. So, yeah, I think absolutely, George, I think you could make that step and say there is no federal right to a firearm. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be back. This is an amazing discovery. Thanks again, Shano, for pointing this out to me. The hidden history of the Second Amendment. I'm going to have to do some thinking and some writing on this as well over the weekend. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with your calls right after this. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Shano Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our radio researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for our video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, everyone at the various companies that syndicate our program, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, CRN Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers that carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, etc., all the others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, or our underwriters, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Thank you very much. Stephen in San Francisco. Hey, Stephen, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the situation here in California and get your thoughts.
You're talking about Jerry Brown balanced your budget.
Yes. Well, as they relate to our federal government, you know, here in California, the people voted for Jerry Brown as a governor and supporting his agenda. Mm. We had the same kind of gridlock in our state legislature with the Republicans wanting to stonewall everything that he or any Democrats put forward. So Jerry Brown took his agenda to the people.
Yep.
Took it to the people to vote for and was overwhelmingly supported.
And now Proposition 30. Yeah. That raise taxes on rich people, basically.
Why can't the President of the United States take his agenda to the people if the Republicans want to block him every step of the way?
A couple of reasons. First, he doesn't. There's no federal version of the California referendum system where people can vote on legislation. It's simply not an option. We have a representative democratic republic, not a direct democracy or direct republic. So you and I cannot propose legislation, and there's no way to get it on a national ballot. The closest we can get to that is amendments to the Constitution. And on July 4th, there's going to be a right-wing group that's trying to amend our Constitution to make the United States as crippled and disabled as California was by requiring the legislature to have a two-thirds supermajority to raise taxes on rich people, which is why Jerry Brown had to go to the people instead of just running it through the state house.
Right.
Number
well,
two,
the
second reason why the president can't do it is that even though Democrats nationwide, even though Democratic members of the House of Representatives got 1.5 million more votes than Republicans of the House of Representatives, there is still a majority of Republicans in the House of Representatives, and that has to do with gerrymandering. It has to do with rigging, electoral system, electoral districts, regions. And the bottom line is that the Republicans can no longer win with a simple majority. They can't win the White House. They can't, and so they're trying to gerrymander that. They've got this plan where they're going to have individual states allocate their electoral votes based on congressional districts. They can't win congressional districts without rigging the game. They can't win without the popular vote without rigging the game. And so we saw somewhere between 8 and 12 million people in the last election whose vote either didn't get counted or were not allowed to vote because the Republicans rigged the game and said, no, if you don't have a particular type of ID and you're not going to be able to vote. It's all about rigging the game for the Republicans, and the filibuster in the Senate is another example of rigging the game. Even though the Democrats have a majority in the Senate, they've not been able to pass legislation for 2 years because the Republicans, with their minority, have rigged the game with the filibuster. So, you know, those are the two reasons why the president can't do what Jerry Brown did. Now, what he could do that gets a little bit close to what Jerry Brown did is he can use the bully pulpit of the White House. He could go on national television. He could hold press conferences. He could constantly be haranguing Congress to pass legislation. But the fact of the matter is that over time, he would look weaker and weaker and weaker as Mitch McConnell blocked it in the Senate with a filibuster. And as, you know, Paul Ryan and John Boehner and Eric Cantor and Kevin McCarthy in the House of Representatives refused to allow these budget bills to either come into committee or even come to the floor of the House. So he's really in a box. And it's going to take a massive turnout by the people in the 2014 election and a massive awakening between now and 2014. People realize that the Republicans just explicitly are operating in the interest of the 1% and don't give a rat's patootie about the 99%. So, Stephen, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Excellent question. Kevin in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Kevin.
Hi, Tom. My comment, I guess, about the gun control legislation is that it seems like it's putting the genie back in the bottle. I was raised here in the Friends meeting, Quaker meeting in Eugene, and was raised pacifist. And I don't think there's going to be a change until people stop thinking that they have to have guns in order to be safe. I personally don't feel safe around guns, and I honestly don't understand why other people do.
Well, we did have a time in the United States in the late 20s, when there were a lot of machine guns floating around. The gun manufacturers were cranking them out as fast as they possibly could, and organized crime was using them like there was no tomorrow, and, you know, the whole Elliot Ness versus John Dillinger and all that stuff. And we banned them in the 30s.
Right.
I think it was in 35. It might have been even before that. When Roosevelt ended Prohibition, he also banned machine guns. And
right.
You don't see any machine guns anymore. I mean, it took a generation or so to kind of wring them out of the system, but now they're museum pieces.
It's hard to hear all these reports about all these AK-47s or whatever they are flying off the shelves and all the clips and everything else as we discuss the issue. I really appreciated the comment yesterday by the man who was talking about how if you have a gun in a situation where people are shooting and you're supposedly trying to protect other people, the police come and you're likely to be the one shot.
Right.
And I also think that the heroes that talked the student out of the gun yesterday in Calis was the teachers that talked
a student out at the gun yesterday.
They were heroes. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Kevin. Kevin, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for watching or listening or whichever it was, wherever you are. Coming up Monday, he was in charge of U.S. operations in Afghanistan, resigned in controversy after remarks made by his staff appearing in Rolling Stone magazine. Now he's back with his memoirs, My Share of the Task. We'll have a conversation here on the program with retired General Stanley McChrystal. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Occupy something. Show up. Participate. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.